Morning, everybody. Today is Monday, November 21. Thank you very much. This is BioChem 421. We're dealing with the end of chapter 18 and moving on quickly to chapter 19. And let's begin with a word of prayer, shall we? Lord, thank you again for a great weekend, for a time of relaxation and recreation. We're facing some travels, Lord, and we're facing a joyful time at home. We ask that we would have that opportunity to make that happen, to be safe as we travel, safe as we don't travel, and to have that time to truly be thankful for the many blessings that we have. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. A truly unique American tradition. All right, we're dealing with chapter 18, and this is at the very end of it. I just want to quickly review some of this. We ran past this, not ran past it, but we worked on this, and I want again remind you of the implications of this one right here. We need to understand what they've done by adding succinate. When this experiment, if you recall, has got an oxygen concentration probe, a measuring device for oxygen concentration, in a solution of mitochondria that's deficient in reduction power or reduced molecules such as succinate and ADP and phosphate. So here you see, under normal circumstances, when you add succinate and phosphate, nothing happens. But when you add a small amount of ADP, then there is a concentration of oxygen is consumed. Add more ADP, it's consumed again. At that horizontal row right there, that horizontal area of that upper left-hand graph on overhead number 8, that horizontal line indicates that ADP has been consumed. What little they added, they add a little bit more ADP, and then oxygen's consumed, but then it flattens out again, indicating the ADP is used up. And then, of course, the uncoupler simply punches a hole in the model is that it punches a hole in the membrane and allows the free flow of hydrogen ions between the matrix and the intermembrane region. And thus you get a rapid, useless consumption of oxygen until there is no more oxygen and everything else is used up. Obviously, there's plenty of succinate when they add that. Then the last figure, what they call letter A here on overhead number 8. They've added the succinate, they added the inorganic phosphate, they added the oligomycin, and then they added the ADP. Of course, what does the oligomycin do? It inhibits the what? ATP synthase. And of course, then when you add the ADP, then there continues to be no oxygen consumption. Then when they add the uncoupler, which bypasses the blockage of by oligomycin, then you get this rapid, uncontrolled oxygen consumption. And how these two experiments relate to the chemiosmotic theory would be a very handy thing to know. Yes? Sure.
How come when the graph on the left, it's not a flat straight line.
Right. Well, my only guess is that there might have been some residual ADP that was left in the preparation of the mitochondria is the best thing I could tell you. Why does ADP not make the bottom one change? The key to understanding that is, what is oligomycin attacking? What is oligomycin attacking? When you look at the model, let's see here. When you look at this model, this complex 5 is that ATP synthase that oligomycin blocks. So when they add oligomycin to this, at this point, in the mitochondria, complex 5 is no longer operational. It cannot work. And complex 5 is where ADP is consumed. So The previous experiments had ADP as a limiting reagent, and therefore when you added ADP, it could complete this particular chemical reaction. But with oligomycin there, whether there's ADP or not, that chemical reaction is not going to occur. And that's why you get no oxygen consumption after ADP is acted upon. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Thank you for that question. Absolutely. You will need to understand this thoroughly. Okay, and then we went through and looked at some of the things that acted upon this. I really want you, this is overhead number 9 now in chapter 18. Of the two enzyme activities that are highly controlled, you'll see, of course, the phosphofructokinase 1 has a tremendous level of control where you have alternatingly active allosteric effectors and deactivating allosteric effectors for that, and also the pyruvate dehydrogenase. If you recall, those are the two most complicated and finely tuned regulatory or controlled enzymes, and you can expect that if I ask about enzyme control, it will be asking about one of those two. Okay, so you please have a thorough knowledge about the regulatory control of those two enzymes. Those two enzymes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's the phosphofructokinase 1. It's just the PFK1 and the pyruvate dehydrogenase. Those two. Both of those have aspects of both covalent control and allosteric control, and therefore have a very complicated regulatory scheme, as it were. As it says here in this overhead, these are the systems that control the cell's metabolism allosterically and moment by moment. So things that control an enzyme activity allosterically, typically are those things which are internal to the cell, in other words, that it's based on the cell's needs, and can be modified quickly. Allosteric control is a very quick modification. Whereas covalent systems that use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, or calcium, or phosphoinositol phosphate, those second messenger systems are in response to an external signal. So in general, notice I said, in general, covalent modification systems that act upon the phosphates and the kinases and other, the RTKs, the receptor tyrosine kinase systems, those are typically responding to some sort of hormonal system, a signal or external signal. It's a sort of a system-wide regulation. How can this cell help the system? Now, this is this is what's known as the PDO, P to O ratio. I think I mentioned this earlier. We're talking about the phosphorylation to oxygen ratio is what that P to O ratio is. This is number 10 overhead. Phosphorylation to oxidation, oxygen use, I guess is how you'd have to say it. A ratio. ATP is synthesis decoupled to the proton gradient. This is not an integral number. It's not 1 or 3 or 6. It's something in between, although people have arbitrarily assigned whole numbers to it as a way of maintaining some sort of accounting of ATPs versus NADHs and so on. But the pumping isn't, of course, 100% efficient, and there is some proton leakage, and so there's about 2.5 ATP per oxygen. You could also say 2.5 ATP per NADH. I've seen these numbers, and you kind of need to keep them in the back of your mind. I've seen 3 ATP for every 1 NADH. I've seen 2 ATP generated for every 1 FADH2. And then from there, you start getting pretty deep into the woods. And, for example, this particular comment and what's in your text, they claim 2.5 ATP per oxygen. That could also be interpreted as 2.5 ATP per NADH. Dr. Novak, does that mean when they're talking probably 1.5 ATP per FADH2? I'd have to put a question mark in front of both of those, but this statement right here, I wouldn't claim that necessarily. This 2.5 number is pretty solid. It's either going to be 2.5 or 3, and the FADHs are pretty much always 2. I've never seen anything less than 2 for FADH2, the energy equivalent for that reduced compound. All right, keep that in mind. Among the other 10 bazillion things you have to keep in mind as a biochemist. Now we're going to move on to chapter 19. And let's see here. Where is chapter 19? Chapter 19 right there.
Just a clarification. Is the next class going to include chapters 13 through 19?
Mm-hmm. 13 through 19. Everything we cover. Everything we cover. Oh, don't you just love this? Oh, my goodness. Now then, photosynthesis, ladies and gentlemen. This is next on our line. Okay. Photosynthesis. What I'm going to do, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to send you the filled-out form for this, all right, for photosynthesis. Matter of fact, I'm going to send out the completed forms for the rest of the semester to you. So what I want you to do is I want you to listen, especially with photosynthesis, because while there's a couple questions about photosynthesis on the test, and it's fascinating work. We definitely need to get to fat metabolism as quickly as we can. Fat metabolism has direct health implications for you folks, for everybody, for you folks and me, especially me. So if you wouldn't mind just listening about what we're going to be doing here with photosynthesis. And I will highlight what the only notes I need for you to do is to... write down what I tell you to write down. All right. At any rate, this is a fantastic quote from Mrs. White on the first page of Photosynthesis. The harvest of life is character, and it is this that determines destiny for both this life and the life to come. You're developing your characters. Many of you have already had much of your character already formed. But nevertheless, there can be life-changing events that change your character, or can if you let them. If it's a change of character that enables you to be live a life of integrity and of other-centeredness and of compassion, that's a good change. If it's a change that causes you to live more selfishly, take shortcuts ethically, that's a bad thing. Right. In this world, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to meet many, 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 and it seems increasingly, unethical people. Some of them in very high places and with great authority, and the damage that they can do to individuals and to the society is enormous because of their unethical behavior. I would urge you, as you live your life, to, no matter how personally painful it might be because of your own failings, always, always take responsibility for what you do and live your life in the highest level of ethical behavior. That you can put your head, when you go to sleep at night, that you can go to sleep not worrying about who you have to lie to next. You hear of Bernie Madoff? He was a financier who ran what's known as a Ponzi scheme, and that is, early investors got their money back from later investors, and the later investors invariably lost their money. And that's exactly what happened. He was such a great confidence man, and had such an impeccable resume that he lost, what was it, between $2 and $3 billion for people. The shock of that betrayal was so intense to his own family that his own son committed suicide. What a high price to pay for a lack of integrity. Please, I urge you, live a life of integrity. Be honest with yourself and with your family. Hold yourself to the highest levels of doing the right thing at the right time. Yes, we all have personal failings, and yes, it's embarrassing to admit that. But when you have an opportunity to be held accountable, accept it as a measure of growth. All right, it does have eternal implications. Now, if I can quickly run through this for you. Let's see here. Too fast. Sorry about that. I'm going to have to put that little tag one line before the end, not at the end. Okay, photosynthesis. How many appreciate photosynthesis? Raise your hand if you appreciate. Yeah, absolutely. We should all appreciate photosynthesis. Again, what is the minimum level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere necessary for plants to seed? What did I tell you? What was it? 200 parts per million. What's the minimum necessary for plants to survive? Not even seed, but just survive. 150 parts per million. That's correct. So there is a minimum level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it has to be there. It has to be there just for this. As a matter of fact, there are plants that go through extraordinary measures to try to concentrate the amount of carbon dioxide in their leaves. So the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere for plants is completely irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. Okay, at any rate, so photosynthesis. It's the exact opposite of oxidation. It's reduction. It is essentially reduction. If you recall a scale of carbon dioxide and methane, you will notice an oxidation scale. I think I may have shown this to you before. Right now, I'm writing on the board CH4, then CH3OH, then with the reversible arrows. These are not resonance forms. CH2 double bond O, an aldehyde. And then a carboxylic acid group. And then finally, reversibly, we get carbon dioxide. This is the reduction oxidation scale for carbon. And we live on a planet that shifts between one and the other, in which plants take carbon dioxide and reduce it, typically to alcohol or aldehyde type structures. Sometimes all the way over here as fats. I would claim that CH4 would represent what a fat is. That I would claim as well that these things here, the carboxylic, the alcohols and the aldehydes, that represents carbohydrates or sugars. Sugars. That's what plants do. And they do that by extracting energy from the sun and reducing these things. The advantage for them, of course, is they use these sugars. They use the sugars for structure. They use the fats and package them in seeds and use that as a means of spreading their genetic material. We as humans, then, and other mammals and other autotrophs, take this and reverse this process and reduce everything back down to carbon dioxide. In the meantime, the energy that was captured as the reduced carbon, we absorb and use to defeat entropy and then release carbon dioxide. One of the interesting things, and I think I've mentioned this before, is one of the interesting ways you can look at the thermodynamics of your body is that you absorb order and reject disorder, and the difference is the entropy or the decrease in entropy that you use to keep yourself occupied. In total, alive. Because fats and sugars are at a lower entropy than carbon dioxide. Obviously they are. They're solids. And when you release them as carbon dioxide and gases, we know entropy increases dramatically. So you absorb highly organized materials, you reject or eliminate disorganized materials, and the difference is what keeps yourself battling against the forces of entropy. All right, now, if you can imagine what goes on here, we have the situation where water is oxidized. Now, biochemically, that's a very powerful thing. Things have got the biochemistry of oxidizing water. That takes a lot of power. And we'll see how the plant accumulates that power. That they strip electrons from water and use those electrons to reduce carbon dioxide to form carbohydrates and fats. This requires direct energy, light energy, and called the light reactions. The production of high-energy electrons is the light reaction. And the products of light reaction and was mislabeled dark reactions. These are reactions that can occur in the dark if you provide them right materials, but typically don't occur in the dark. Occurs in the chloroplast of cells. You need to recall the primary structure of the chloroplast. There are three compartments in the chloroplast: intermembrane compartment, stroma, and thylakoid compartment. In the stroma, that's this area right in here where there's lots of membrane. Carbohydrate synthesis occurs, DNA, RNA, ribosomes for protein synthesis. The thylakoid compartment, that's that inner compartment, is where the light harvesting complexes occur, electron transport occurs, ATP synthesis. And these stacks of the thylakoids create these granums, the granums that they're called. So you've got the granum, the stroma, inner membrane, outer membrane. Notice it looks a lot like the mitochondria because it's a double membrane material, organelle. Tremendously complex interior compartments. All right, next. The structure of the chlorophyll and light harvesting complex. Let's see here. And, okay, light. Now, all right, so chlorophyll. What is the other compound that's fairly related to chlorophyll except has iron in it? Hemoglobin, that's exactly correct. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, the structural similarity is remarkable between the two. The primary difference between the two is the metal ion in the center ligated to the nitrogen. We have some minor variations of chlorophyll. Chlorophyll A, B, bacterial chlorophyll A and B. These things are highly conjugated. And the more conjugated, the lower the absorption frequency becomes, or the longer the wavelength. In other words, double bonds that are not conjugated together. You know what conjugation is. Alternating. Okay, this is why you take organic before you come here. The organic chemicals that are not highly conjugated absorb only in the ultraviolet region. Whereas you add more conjugation, the absorption spectrum drops, and you can begin to absorb it in the visible spectrum, and that's where conjugated compounds then become much more, well, colorful, as it were, as they accept or reject photons based on their structure, where they absorb a photon, where they reject a photon. I love this color blue, but in fact, the chemical in this fabric that makes it blue is actually absorbing every color but blue. Is that correct? So it's absorbing red and yellow. It's absorbing green and rejecting blue, reflecting it. All right. So there are other compounds that absorb photon energy, but they do not they absorb the energy, but they do not have the same particular behaviors that chlorophyll has. You have these phycoerythrins, phycocyanins, and carotenoids. They absorb these various colors of light. And not surprisingly, that phycoerythrin and phycocyanin, since these are water-dwelling bacteria, they absorb down the yellow and red regions because ultraviolet and blue does not penetrate water. That's why water is what? Blue. Reflects blue. Okay. So if the blue isn't getting through, they absorb the energy that is getting through, and that turns out to be yellow and red. Let's take a look at some of these. Of course, you've got this top line right here is the solar spectrum in terms of the amount of energy being delivered by the sun at these particular wavelengths. These high wavelengths, of course, these small wave numbers are blues and ultraviolets and greens and this kind of thing. 500, 600. 600 is definitely red and kind of the orange, red-orange kind of thing. And this is green-ish. And so you can see here, if we take a look at chlorophyll, it absorbs in two different spectrums. It absorbs sort of in the blue spectrum, and it comes down here, doesn't absorb in this green, and then it absorbs more down in the red. So you have kind of a blue spectrum, blue absorption, doesn't absorb greenish, then it does absorb sort of red, and that's why chlorophyll is green. It is not absorbing that particular and peculiar frequency. It's absorbing a higher energy, higher frequency, or shorter wave number. It's also absorbing at the longer wavelengths, a lower frequency down here in the reds. And so the combination of some of these allows it to be just about every frequency to be absorbed. But the primary, like the beta carotenoids, they're shifted a little bit. Let's see here. They stop right there. They shift a little bit, and they do absorb some of the green. That's why they have that orange color with them. All right, and you can see here, you've got chlorophyll, you've got iron. Don't you just love that combination there? The chlorophylls, there are various R groups in the nonpolar region that are changed. Notice they're conjugated. They have a double bond character. Some of them do. And because of that conjugation, they then are able to shift their absorption of the frequencies that they do. Let's see here. The iron here is simply as a comparison between that and magnesium. All right, let's go ahead, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? And then what happens here? Oxidation of water occurs in the photosynthetic reaction centers. And I'll stop. Okay. So what happens here is there's a lot more chlorophyll in a leaf than where it actually strips electrons away from oxygen. So there's a large antenna complex with a few reaction centers in which the actual absorption of light energy is linked to the release of oxygen as an oxidized compound. So what happens is these antenna complexes come in and a photon hits these various chlorophylls and literally wanders around until it falls into a reaction center. So as these photons land on a particular chlorophyll, and it raises its internal energy, that internal energy is transferred almost in a completely lossless sense from one chlorophyll to the next until these things wander around in really a random sense and run into a reaction center. Reaction centers are hit by photons themselves directly only about 1 second. But they receive photon energy much more often than that. So you have the chlorophyll A and B, along with these other pigments which I mentioned earlier, create these LHCs, which stand, of course, for what? What does it say up here? That's correct. So these complexes absorb the photons, transfer them losslessly until they find a reaction center. So what are the elevated energy states of chlorophyll once a photon hits? Well, you absorb a nice blue photon, chlorophyll, and so you have an elevated high-energy electron. What happens to that? First of all, there's an internal conversion in which you go from a high-energy state to a lower-energy state, and it produces heat. So if you were to measure the temperature of a leaf in bright sunlight, it would be slightly more elevated than the air around it. As these photons were descending from a high second energy state into a first excited state that's released as heat. And if you could measure that, you'd see that the leaves are slightly warmer than the surrounding air. Once they drop down into this, and they don't all go to the second excited state, some just go to the first excited state. For example, if it's absorbed red light, that's where that goes. Once you have that, you have fluorescence, which literally means that it releases that energy in a different color. That if you could take chlorophyll and expose it to the right blue light and then look at it through red filters, you would see the chlorophyll glowing a reddish color. The chlorophyll is glowing a slightly red color as it absorbs that blue light. Now, that's sort of a waste of energy, but it happens. It's not possible to do anything else but that. The other fate is this exciton transfer, which is not really shown here. What happens is that this electron can move losslessly to the next chlorophyll. You can see this over here. So this diagram represents three of the four things. This represents the fourth, in which an electron has been promoted to a high energy state and then moves from one state to the next, from one chlorophyll to the next, all at that high energy state, and eventually runs into a reaction center chlorophyll that, due to its peculiar conjugation, is at a slightly lower energy level and lands there and gets trapped. You can also do this photooxidation, which, if you wanted to, it perhaps might be a part of this exciton transfer. This photooxidation chemical reaction, this is what would be occurring at the reaction center chlorophyll. So the majority of chlorophylls actually don't undergo this in a normal state. There are errors, however, and this photooxidation can be a negative thing for the chlorophyll. So in bright sunlight on a sunshiny day in which there's high temperatures and hours and hours and hours of sunlight, the leaf is constantly battling extraneous photooxidation events that could destroy this reaction center, the chemical reaction center, chlorophyll reaction center. And you will find that part of the process there is an unhappy inefficiency that apparently is required to keep photooxidation damage to a minimum. An unhappy oxidation inefficiency. We'll talk about that in a little bit. All right, so the light reaction. The light reaction is one more. Okay. This is, again, a marvelous creation, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who have had this kind of plant biochemistry before, this is review. For those of you who have not, this is a marvelous introduction to the creativity of God, in which the reaction center, not the antenna, but the reaction center, these specialized regions of the antenna field, that the chlorophyll reaction center, has a special set of chlorophylls that are an amazing twofold symmetry. Sort of like this, where my two hands are. And they're in a specific orientation, specific distance apart, and have a peculiar reaction, peculiar fate. The electrons in them have a peculiar fate when a photon strikes them. Okay. So, typically, we're going to look at what happens in the photosynthetic bacteria, but they think, and there's evidence that it's similar to plants, but they can study photosynthetic bacteria a little more effectively. They absorb, in this case, absorbs in the light region. The reaction center occurs in the plasma membrane of the bacteria. of course, that is different than when you, if you have a chlorophyll. But again, remember, we're doing bacteria. This pumps protons out of the bacteria to create a gradient for ATP formation. So you have to ask, okay, here you have a bacteria, photosynthetic bacteria. You have this reaction center that contains chlorophyll. And as a photon hits it, sometimes called H nu, then protons are pumped from the interior of the cell to the exterior of the cell. You know, I always thought when I first looked at this, I said, why don't the photons just float away, just diffuse away? I mean, you got the entire environment out here. Why don't they just diffuse away? We have to understand that once those are pumped outside, you now have electrochemical gradient. That this is partially positive, these are partially charged, and this is negative charged here, separated by a thin membrane. Can someone tell me what that looks like from physics? If you have a negative charge and a positive charge separated by a thin membrane, what do you have there? What is it? A battery or a capacitor? Remember, from a capacitor. Literally, you have, as she says here, a little battery or a little capacitor in which those charges then, the dielectric medium would be the membrane, and that charge can be sensed across that dielectric medium, even though they are in fact not in physical contact, and it holds those positive charges right next to the bacterium, even though there's no physical material holding them there, unlike the mitochondria. All right, so each center contains three hydrophobic subunits, H, L, and M, containing four chlorophyll and two bacteria, phenocytin, an iron, and ubiquitone. There we go. They exist in nearly perfect twofold symmetry. Two of them are called this special pair that behave in a special way. They're parallel. Magnesiums are 7 angstroms apart. Maximum absorption, about 780. The absorption of photon by the special pair excited electrons delocalize over both pair. So the energy that comes from that photon, either a direct hit or transferred by other photons in the complex, create an excited state for these two photons. And that excited state is spread over the two photons. Over the two chlorophylls. So they're sitting there. I'm representing as my two hands vibrating. They're excited there. But that is delocalized over both chlorophylls. That elevated energy, boing, not excited, excited, that photon comes either from a direct hit or from absorption from other chlorophylls. That exists for 3 picoseconds before transferring to the bacterial phenocytin to the right of the figure below, this down here, right over here, pardon me. So, but it always does that. What? It always does that. The symmetry of that complex is so perfect, they cannot determine by X-ray crystallography a variance between one side or another. But they know that always it moves to this one, to this particular bacterial phenophyton, pardon me. And they don't know why. Okay, well, anyway, so that exists for 3 picoseconds. Next 2 picoseconds, it goes down to this pool, methaquinone. The electron transfer is so efficient that the quantum yield is almost exactly 100%. That's amazing. It captures virtually 100% of the energy that it hits. Amazing. So then it moves to the cytochrome BC1 complex. That does the proton pumping right here. The cytochrome BC complex does the proton pumping. And then you get this thing. All right. So this is now overhead number 6, ladies and gentlemen. And there we go. All right. If you've seen this before, I bet you've seen this since high school, haven't you? It's the Z scheme. Is that correct? All right. Well, we're now moving away from the bacteria the photosynthetic bacteria, the model they had for that special pair, it exists in the same thing for plants. So even though we're talking about this plant-like material, this plant-like Z-scheme, the aspect of the photons being absorbed by this special pair are very, very, very similar, if not, in fact, identical. I have one more minute. All right. So, photooxidation pathway. Let's take a look at the big scheme of things. What's the ultimate fate of the electrons generated by this process of stripping electrons from water? What's the ultimate fate? It produces what? The electrons? Did I say oxygen? Anyway, the ultimate fate of the electrons, if I see here, I probably wasn't very specific. I'm sorry. I think I said, what is the ultimate fate? All right, ultimate fate of the electrons generated by the oxidation of water. They produce what? And what do we know NADPH is for? What? Biosynthesis, that's correct. So biosynthesis in animals, in plants, it's all the same thing. Once you make NADPH, its fate is to make stuff. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Notice down here, this is where you have the water coming in and it interrelates. This water comes in working with this OEC. Does anybody know what this EOC is? Remember what it is? Oxygen evolving complex. And notice what trace mineral it has. What trace mineral is Mn? Manganese. Not magnesium, manganese. We'll talk more about this tomorrow. Thank you so much. I'll send you the completed forms for 19 and 20. Print them both out. In fact, I may do that right now. Thank you very much.